Today's Teisho is on case 34 in the Piyen Lu, the Hikigan Roku. Case 34 is entitled Kyozan's You Have Not Visited Ryozan. Main subject, Kyozan asked a monk, Where are you from? Mount Rozan, answered the monk. Have you ever visited Boroho Peak? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, you have not visited Rozan. Later, Umon said, this talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds out of kindness. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down. Faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know Kanzan? He went very fast. 10 years not returning, he forgot the way he had come. So, thank you all for doing such an excellent job this morning in your sitting. I want to say what a pleasure it is to sit with you. And I can see in the screen many people absolutely still through the three sits of the morning. That's really wonderful. I've been talking a lot about habit energies. And habits seem unbreakable, and they aren't easy to change. So, for example, I'm used to going into a room and turning on the light, and in this room there's a motion sensor. So you'll notice that the lights are on, and then we start reciting the sutras, and the lights go off. And that's because the motion sensors are set at a certain height. And sitting on the floor like this, we can be moving around, and it won't notice that. So that's why I was taking the sutra book and waving it in the air. It wasn't proclaiming the sutras. It was just that I had forgotten. My habit is to just come in and turn on the light. I had forgotten it under these circumstances. In just a few minutes, it's going to go dark, and then I won't be able to read anything. So, you know, habits are difficult to break. You know, they become deeply ingrained, and they create our sense of reality. And actually, the sutras say that there's nothing to our sense of reality except habit energy. Stan and I have been reading the Sharangama Sutra, which is a really, really important sutra for Mahayana Buddhism and for Chinese Buddhism in particular. And it's quite concerned with habit energy. Also, the sutra that Bodhidharma Dhammo brought from India to China was the Lankavatara Sutra. Also, very interested in this issue of habit energy. And habit energy is what creates our sense of reality. It does seem that habit energies are difficult to change, because they seem so real and they seem so palpable. But actually that's not necessarily true. You know, when you come to Sesshin, you know, it doesn't take long before you begin to notice your habit energies changing. So, you know, on day one of Sesshin, there's like a classic trajectory. You know, day one of Sesshin is, you know, thinking about all the concerns that you brought with you to the Sesshin. And day two, you know, usually on day one, people are sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? I have so much work. This was a mistake. You know, I'm too busy. And all during the session, they're thinking about, oh dear, that report is due on Tuesday. You know, I'm going to get back from session. I'm going to be tired and I've got to focus and get that report done. And that sort of thing. Then, you know, day two is, you know, usually people are growing tired. And they're beginning to have some physical, the physical discomfort is becoming more pronounced because their defenses are down, right? And then day three, you know, sometime today or tomorrow, if you haven't experienced it already, if you've been sitting quite regularly, you're going to experience a kind of shift of perspective. So that will happen around day three or day four. People who are sitting a lot, you know, will begin to experience a shift in perspective, a deepening in their sitting. And it definitely won't be the case that when you sit down on the mat, all the pain goes away from your legs. That's unlikely to happen. If it does, that's wonderful, but it probably won't last. But what will happen is that around day three, you begin to enter deep samadhi. Deep, we say in Chinese, Mandarin, it's ding. Deep ding. And when you get into deep samadhi, your relationship to everything, including your physical discomfort, changes. You know, on day two, it's hard to get into deep samadhi. You're in a transitional state between your customary consciousness and your deep samadhi consciousness. And you're sort of on the edge of samadhi, but you're not quite there. And that, if you're doing a lot of sitting on the cushion, that can be exquisitely difficult. Because, you know, your legs are tired, get tired by day two, and your back gets tired and so on. But on day three, you know, you'll begin to have these moments where the thoughts become fewer and farther between. And you'll notice that there are these blank spaces between your thoughts. And it's like your head is emptying out and filling up with darkness, basically. It's like your head is a block, right? Block. The great Japanese Buddhist scholar D.T. Suzuki, Taitetsu means blockhead. So, you know, basically, his Dharma name when he formally became a Buddhist and took the precepts, he was given the name Taitetsu, which means blockhead. And you could say, well, how ironic, this great gifted Japanese scholar was called a blockhead, but in Buddhist circles, that's a great compliment to be you're really a blockhead. That's a great compliment because that means you're capable of getting into deep samadhi, like your head is like a block of wood, you know, just absolutely like that. And unfortunately, it's difficult. There's no way to get to that state except to go through day two, in my opinion. So it would be great if somebody could invent a machine that would, actually it wouldn't be great, but somebody might try to come up with a machine that would put you in deep samadhi, but actually, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to work with the body-mind, which is a unity, the body and the mind is like a unity. It's a unified system. And, you know, some people say, my own teacher used to say that the human body was invented for enlightenment. You know, it's like the perfectly designed, according to Buddhist teaching, the human body is perfectly designed for enlightenment. You know, actually, people don't know that. You know, they go through their whole lives. basically, if I may say so, a lot of people waste their lives, if I may say so, if I may be so bold. You know, they chase after this and that, and according to our great Dharma ancestors, they're like chasing ghosts in a forest of dead trees. You know, the human body is like a machine or a device for enlightenment. And most people don't know that, and they go through their lives like, you know, chasing after ghosts in a forest of dead trees. But if you know how to enter Ding, you are on the path. You truly are a stream enterer, you could say. You know, so everything depends on being able to enter samadhi deeply. And your body is attuned to samadhi. It's developed or it's perfectly suited to samadhi. You know, if you go out into the mountains, like I love to hike, and long before I'd heard about Zen, I had learned about hiking. And I would go out in the mountains and just, you know, if you trudge through the mountains for 6 hours, you know, your legs hurt. And you get tired, and you want to quit, right? And you don't quit. You say, well, I promised myself I was going to hike up to this peak so I could look out over this valley. And you trudge up, and you get there. And, you know, on the way up, you think, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And then you get to the top, and you sit down and you rest, and then there's this sense of elation, but also your mind is so clear. Your mind is, clear might not be the right word for it. Your mind is so blockheaded. But now no thoughts. You're just looking out at the world without projecting anything on it or having any conditioned responses to it. And this is like sanity. And the human body loves this experience. The human body loves this. And, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, we're activating the human body. It's so tragic, you know, to see people, if I may say so, right? I mean, if, you know, our world is not doing very well. So I think I'm on firm ground when I say that the world is a very confused place and that a lot of our values are wrong or wrongheaded. And you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, the human being is like an iPhone that's used as a doorstop, right? Or used as a paperweight or something like that. But when we come to Sesshin and we sit down on the cushion and we breathe through the Dantian and we follow the breath out through the Hara, you know, we go through this process. Day one, why am I here? We're still far from activation, you could say. And day two is a bumpy ride. You know, it's like, whoa, you know, this is more than I signed up for. And day three, suddenly we get to this place where we begin to have these experiences of deep samadhi. Entering thoughtlessness, you know, and the mind begins to go blank automatically. Sooner or later, even if you're not calling mu, you might not notice it, but you'll be sitting on the cushion and your mind will go completely blank. You know, I remember being at a sesshin, and our sesshin, Genki Roshi would translate in Dokusan for Genki Roshi, because Genki Roshi's English was so poor. And so Webb would translate, and then Genki would speak, and then Webb would translate from Japanese back into English during Dokusan. So they would both go into the Dokusan room together. And I remember one time, it was sort of the end of a Dokusan period, and that room just exploded with laughter. And Genki Roshi and Webb came out, and the person who had gone into Dokusan later told me what happened. He had gone into Dokusan, and he could not remember his koan. This happens to people, right? They go into, you're meditating for 8 hours a day on your koan, and you go in and you can't remember your koan. And you could say, wow, what's wrong with me? I should be able to remember my koan. But actually, he was in very deep samadhi, very deep samadhi. He was processing the koan on a deeper level. You know, you know, when somebody comes in and says, well, you know, here's my take on the koan. We should be happy with life just as it is, right? That, generally speaking, is an intellectual answer, right? So I've been talking, I always use this as my illustration of a koan. If you have a staff, I'll give you one. If you have no staff, I'll take it away. And people will come into the Dokusan room and say, well, you know, I've been disappointed in certain things, but I need to accept. See, now that's true, but that's a very intellectual answer. I can't tell if that person is in deep ding or not. That sounds like somebody who's just thinking. So, you know, the koans are so occult, they're so complicated and difficult to make sense of, with all these little twists and turns. You know, he lost his eyes, but he got his ears. And you think, what is that all about? Well, they're trying to make it difficult so that the only way you'll understand it is by being in deep samadhi. So you know, koan training is testing your ability to enter ding. And ding usually comes to people with, it requires a little sweat, little perspiration. It's nobody likes day two of sesshin. In fact, day two is usually when people leave sesshin, as a matter of fact. So, you know, basically, somebody left sesshin yesterday, here. So please don't look around and say who's missing, because people are sitting irregularly and so on. But somebody left yesterday, and it's a classic. You know, on day two, people say, oh my God, I'm never getting up this mountain. And day three, they think, oh, thank God I stayed, because it's so, the view from up here on the peak is so wonderful. So basically, you know, human beings are made for samadhi. And even though we have these terrible habits, these habit energies that we've cultivated and that society has encouraged us to adopt, it doesn't really take that long to begin to break down those old habits and become restored to fundamental sanity. See? And I think that's amazing and remarkable, and it confirms the Buddhist teaching that all people are fundamentally enlightened. You know, it doesn't take years and years. It takes a few days, admittedly a few days of difficult practice, rigorous practice. But by around day three of sesshin, people are really changing. You know, they're really melting away their illusions. And they're entering deep ding, deep samadhi. And this, to me, is like amazing, and it's wonderful, and it's why sesshin is like the most amazing human invention, in my opinion. And if you're not there yet, just hang in there. It's like, at some point, everything is, it's going to be like a cloudy, gloomy, sticky day, and suddenly the clouds are going to blow away, and it will be clear and unobstructed in all directions, at least sometimes. And when that happens, you know, you'll know what I mean. So, you know, we do create these terrible habits, and society is really not to be trusted. You know, in my opinion, if I may say so, you know, our society has an interest in addicting you to absolutely millions of things and creating habit energies that are difficult to break. You know, my father died of cancer from smoking. And 20 years before he died, his doctor told him, if you don't quit, you are going to die, he said. My father's name was Larry. He said, Larry, if you don't quit, you're going to die. And my father could not quit, even though he knew that he was going to die, right? He switched from cigarettes to cigars, which is not really an improvement. It's, you know, he would inhale cigars, so, and deny that he was inhaling. But, you know, somebody had a brilliant idea that tobacco, which actually among Native Americans was this sacred plant. People only smoked tobacco on ritual occasions. It was this wonderful, they'd smoke it and that nicotine rush would elevate their consciousness. But we took it and turned it into a consumption commodity and addicted millions of people. And lots of things work like that. Lots of things work like that. I mean, when I was about 12 years old, I realized that I was addicted to television because my whole family would come in at the end of the day and watch TV. And even though nothing was on that we liked, we wouldn't get up and walk away from the TV. And everybody would sit around and complain, there's nothing on TV. Oh my God, you know, there were only used to be about seven channels or something, right? And the knob on our TV was broken, so we had a pair of pliers. And we'd go up and take the pliers and turn. This is before you could press like this. You had to get up and actually turn a knob, like on an oven, right? It was like settings. It was like this channel, one, two, three, four. And we'd get up and we'd turn the channel and it's like, God, there's nothing on. And then we'd all sit back down and just watch this crap, right? And that's addiction. It's absolutely addiction. Nobody shot anything into his veins, but it's definitely addictive behavior. And there's tons of those. When we come to Sesshin, though, you know, something really wonderful happens. It takes about 3 days, right? And if you work with the process, if you trust in the process, with great regularity, after about 3 or 4 days, you're going to be entering samadhi. And it does require certain things from you. You really have to sit still. You have to be motionless, even if you feel like you're feeling going to go crazy. And, you know, if you're sitting in a chair, that's a very difficult situation. You know, basically, it would be much better for you if you sat on the mat. If you have an injury or some other physical problem that prevents you from sitting on a mat, that's okay. But, you know, you don't see any statues of the Buddha sitting in a chair, right? And there's a reason for that. You know, it's because this posture, the seated meditation posture is ideally designed for entering samadhi. So there's a range of different postures you can adopt. They don't have to be lotus posture, full lotus, half lotus, Burmese. There's a number of different seiza, all of those and variations thereof. But you really need to work with the whole body-mind system. And this is very different, right, from how we normally live. You know, people get up in the morning and maybe they turn on the TV. People actually do that. It's such a bad idea. And they turn on the TV. I lived with a bunch of guys in college. They would get up in the morning and the first thing they would do is like, what's on TV? And then they go, oh, there's nothing on TV. And then they drink their coffee and watch TV. It's like, ah. And when I was living in Seattle, I started going to a Zen center to meditate because I wanted to meditate at home. But there were these two Iranian guys in the basement, and at like 5 in the morning, they would turn the TV on. And it's like, what are they doing? There's nothing on TV at 5 in the morning. I think they were just feeling lonely. So lots of people do that. They turn the TV on, then they clean the house. And they feel like, well, you know, I'm here with whoever, you know, I'm here with whoever's on TV, The View or something, and I understand that, but we have a lot of habits that aren't necessarily good for us. And when we come to Sesshin, we go through like this retooling, this reconstruction of our body-mind experience. And by around day three, it's really liberating. It really began to change. And if you've had the experience of deep samadhi, that's probably why you're here, because you've had that experience. And if you want to wake up, you need to make time in your life for that experience. You have to make a lot of time. But notice that usually our life outside of Zen is different from our life at Sesshin. And often there's a huge distance between those two things. So you know, a person who came to Sesshin and left actually said to me something which I understand. This is a very human thing. The person said, "I can't do Sesshin at home. I'm surrounded by my creature comforts, basically, my comforts." You know, so the person can't get up at 4, 5:30 or 6 o'clock to get to Zen at 7. You know, when he's in his own bed, it's just too hard to wake up. It sounds funny, but it's so human, right? We're all like this. It's why we come to Sesshin. So, you know, it's like when you're at home, if the TV's over there and it's, you know, it's 5:30, you think, oh, I could be watching, or when, you know, whatever. Or you think, right now, or it's Saturday, tomorrow's Saturday. You know, especially in the fall, there's all this football on, right? Basically, you know, if it's Saturday, you look over and you think, my God, it's the Steelers versus the Rams, or I have no idea if they even exist anymore. You know, I'm not a sports fan, but it's the Steelers versus the Rams. I've got to watch that game, right? So it's understandable. Or maybe your refrigerator is full of snacks, right? So, you know, you're meditating, but when you feel anxiety, you want to go to the refrigerator and have a snack, or maybe you want a drink, you want a beer, right? When you feel stress, the stress of sitting, you want to go in and have a beer and relax, right? So you know, basically, if we're not careful, what we can do is create a kind of split between our Zen practice world and our everyday life. Years ago, I went to a Sesshin with up in New York State, Daigo Satsu Sesshin. And I was staying with a person who knew the teacher there very well. And he was asked to speak at the end of the session. Different people were asked to stand up and speak about their experience, something we never do. This person said, you know, I come to session once a year, and he said, to get my ass kicked. That's what he said. And everybody laughed, you know, get my ass kicked. And he said, this is like going to Buddha camp. So he goes to Sesshin once a year, and he experiences this very pure way of living. And then he goes home, and he goes back to his regular life. And every year he sort of does penance by coming up and doing one Sesshin. Now, you know, I think that's a mistake. You know, one of the things that is happening as a result of what we're doing now, the Zoom Sesshin, is that it's actually collapsing the wall between your Zen life and your everyday life. You're actually practicing Sesshin in your own home, right? And I think that's, I never thought of this. But when this guy said to me, I just can't do this, what he was really saying is, my Zen life and my everyday life are so different, I can't bring them together. And that's totally understandable. I'm not criticizing. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. That's so interesting. And then I remembered this guy who went to this sesshin, and basically he would have this week of ding, deep of week of enlightened practice. And then he'd go home and who knows what he did, right? You know, but basically his Zen practice wasn't changing his life. What he had done was to take it and build a little wall around it, right? It's like when I'm in the Zen world, I'm in the Zen world. And when I'm not in the Zen world, I'm not in the Zen world. And I'm going to keep them very separate, right? And I think that's a great tragedy, because unless you integrate your practice with your daily life, this is not really transformative in any meaningful sense. Coming to Sesshin once a year to quote-unquote get your ass kicked is not the way to enlightenment, right? It's really saying, I don't want to change my life. I don't want to change my life. I don't want to be enlightened. That's for the Buddha to be enlightened. I just want to come here and like burn off a little of my bad karma. So what we're doing, it occurred to me after this, is really great. I mean, would I prefer to be at Murray Grove right now, watching the hummingbirds fly around the window? Yes, I would love that. But you know, when people come to Sesshin and it's just a five-day experience of the Buddhist world and then you go home, something is wrong with your practice. You know, what has to happen is that integration. You don't have to get up every day and recite the 25th chapter of the Lotus Sutra as we do every morning, or as I try to do with various levels of success. But gradually collapsing that wall is a good idea. You know, the sort of the theme of this sesshin has been habits and changing habits. You know, and our world, our world is literally on fire, and our society is very unhealthy. And you know, I believe that we can recreate our lives through meditation practice. We can change our way of living. And the world will be better if we take this outside, take this with us outside, and also if we bring the outside in here. You know? So you know, let me just go back to the koan since I haven't gotten to it yet. Kyozan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" "Mount Rozan," answered the monk. "Have you ever visited Goroho Peak?" asked Kyozan. "No, not yet," said the monk. Kyozan said, "You have not visited Rozan." So, in other words, you know, one way to think about this is, have you gone to Sesshin? Yes, I've gone to Sesshin. You know, but how deeply have you integrated Sesshin into your life? Right? How deeply, and how do you do that? It doesn't mean getting up and reciting the Lotus Sutra, but we begin to dissolve that boundary in koan practice, and we keep doing that, and the boundary should eventually dissolve. So you know, when people can enter deep samadhi, deep ding, sometimes it's just beautiful. Like on day three of sesshin, you've gone through all this pain, and suddenly your mind empties out and becomes blank. And sometimes in that on that third day of Sesshin, you can begin to enter, like you can have moments of real bliss. You know, you go outside and everything is so alive and you're not thinking so much, so you can experience the world in this beautiful way. It's like everything has been cleansed, right? You know, and you can say, oh, you know, Zen is so wonderful. This is the spiritual world. This is purity and so on. But you know, if you stay in that place, you are not really liberated. You know, being able, it's absolutely essential to be able to enter Ding, to be able to enter Samadhi, and enter so deeply that everything disappears. But if you cling to that purity, that clarity, and you don't integrate, see, you're trapped. You've made a bad habit out of samadhi. You know, so the method of koan training is to give you a question that is going to sort of like drag your life into this, right? And so if the teacher gives you a koan, you know, it may take a while, but eventually, you know, you might suddenly find as you're working with a koan that you feel angry, or you might, as you're working with the koan, think of your troubled relationship with your father, or you might think of experience of loss. You know, maybe you lost somebody to cancer or something like that. You know, and suddenly you feel very sad or very angry, and you think, well, this is a distraction from the purity of samadhi. See, and actually, no, this is the path to liberation. Is working through we create a boundary between our samadhi world and the world outside our samadhi world, if that makes any sense. And we preserve that, you know, we all preserve that world to some degree because it's so beautiful, it's like heaven, right? But in order to make heaven complete, you have to bring in the hell, right? You have to bring in the hell. So, you know, koan practice you could think of as bringing the hell into heaven. And, you know, when we work on our koans, we transform the hell into heaven, if that makes any sense. We transform, through the power of deep machine, we work through our obstacles. And it's like our practice is like a series of circles, like concentric circles. You know, the first circle is pure samadhi, and then you work on this koan, and now the circle is a little bigger, and then it's a little bigger, and then it's a little bigger, until it takes in everything. So there's no outside and inside. There's no enlightened world and non-enlightened world. There's no Zen world and non-Zen world. So if you have not yet gotten to deep ding, please work on deep ding. If you are working on your koan, it's difficult. It's challenging because, you know, it's like bringing the hell into heaven. Who wants to bring the hell into heaven? Joshu was asked a question. Somebody said to Joshu, I won't be able to get this right, but somebody said to something like to Joshu, monks who break the precepts go to the deepest hell. And Joshu said, well, I'll be the first to go. And that sounds like, what? I'll be the monks who break the precepts. Monks who break their vows go straight to the deepest hell. And Joshu said, well, you know, count me in, count me in. And you think, what is he saying? What he's saying is, of course, the bodhisattva's task is to go to the deepest hell and transform it into the heaven of awakened mind. And that's what we're all doing. We're all doing the bodhisattva task at Sesshin. we're working through our own personal hells, but we're also transforming everything around us. Main subject. Kyozan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" "Mount Rozan," answered the monk. "Have you visited Goroho Peak?" asked Kyozan. "No, not yet," said the monk. Kyozan said, "Then you have not visited Rozan." So have you had samadhi? Yes. You know, and then he's saying, have you gone into hell with samadhi? And he says, "Not yet." And Kyozan said, "Then you haven't found heaven, basically." Later, Umon said, "This talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds out of kindness. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down. Faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know, this is Kanzan, is actually Hanshan. This is Hanshan. Don't you know Hanshan? He went very fast. 10 years not returning, he forgot the way he had come." See, this is very important. Hanshan left home, and when you really leave home, you don't even remember how to get back. When you have really integrated your life fully with enlightened consciousness, you don't even want to go, you don't want to go back, right? This is a line from Hanshan's poetry, his wonderful poetry. "This is my resting place. Hanshan knows the best retreats. The breeze blows through the pines, sounding better the nearer it is. Under a tree, I'm reading Lao Tzu, quietly perusing. 10 years not returning, I've forgotten the way I came." So everything can be integrated into your awakened mind of samadhi, and that's the work we're doing today. And it's the work we have to do when we leave here too. And the wonderful thing about what we're doing is Zen is right in your living room, and that's exactly where it should be, or wherever you're sitting, your closet, your